You're listening to New Voices, a production of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This podcast is sponsored by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and partner institutions.
I'm Olivia Branscombe.
And I'm Haley Brennan.
In this episode, I talk to Xu Chen Xian, professor of philosophy at Zhejiang University. We discuss her book, Chinese Cosmopolitanism, The History and Philosophy of an Idea. We talk about a Chinese metaphysics of harmony, how that metaphysics informs thinking about social identity and difference, and the goals of comparative philosophy.
Hi, I'm Xu Chen Xiang. I'm a professor of philosophy at Zhejiang University in China. And previous to that, I was assistant professor of philosophy at Peking University, China.
Okay, so today our conversation is going to focus on your forthcoming book, Chinese Cosmopolitanism. So I want to get started by asking you first to describe your book project a bit, and then just how you came to take on this particular project.
The book is, as the title suggests, about Chinese conceptions of cosmopolitanism, and the really ideas to do with pluralism. So how I got interested in working in this project was that my first book was entitled A Philosophical Defense of Culture, Perspectives from Confucianism and Kassira, and that book was published in 2021 by SUNY. And this book really, the current book, Chinese Cosmopolitanism, really came out of that first project, because I had this kind of interest in Chinese issues to do with pluralism from that first project. So that first project was focusing on, well, as the title suggests, a philosophical account of culture, especially from a kind of Chinese perspective. And I came to the realization as I was writing that first book of how important this idea of pluralism was to the Chinese conception, or Chinese Confucian. I say Chinese Confucian because Confucianism was such a dominant part of the philosophical, well, Chinese philosophical tradition. So I kind of tend to talk about them together. So I sort of, in that book, I realized the importance of pluralism for the Confucian ideas about culture. And so my current book grew out of that. So in the last chapter of that book, I have this beautiful phrase from the Chinese classics. So the last chapter of that book was called Wu Yi Wu Wen and : organic harmony. So that expression means that without Wen, so in that Chinese phrase that I said, Wen, without Wen, which means anything from civilization to culture to refinement to literature or writing, when there is merely homogeneity, there is no possibility of Wen. So that's what that phrase means. And I thought that was, you know, that there's one phrase that expresses that, but really there's many, many aspects of Chinese philosophy, the metaphysics of it, that express that particular idea. That idea was just talked about very beautifully in that phrase. So from that first book, I was making the point that really embedded in this tradition was the idea that pluralism and difference was necessary for the possibility of culture and civilization. And so Chinese cosmopolitanism develops on those kind of more very academic interests about the necessity of difference for the possibility of culture. But then there's more, apart from those kind of really academic interests, there's more, I also have these very, well, you could say more contemporary interests in things like the critical philosophy of race. And I wanted to join my interests in ideas about Chinese metaphysics to these more contemporary interests and issues that I think of as very important if we try to think about dealing with contemporary ethical issues.
So your book is such a rich exploration of several issues, as you just described. I want, just for the moment, to kind of break down these elements and ask you about each in turn. So you claim that, first, pluralism and difference is necessary for culture, and that this claim is rooted in or derived from Chinese metaphysics or the history of Chinese metaphysical theories. Mm-hmm. And then in turn that these metaphysical theories and pluralism that emerges from them can intervene in or help us to understand contemporary ethical issues, especially claims about hierarchies.
Yeah.
So let's start with the first one, with pluralism and difference. What do you mean when you say this? What kind of ideas of difference are you talking about in the book?
Yeah, so it can extend from just the metaphysical level to then the social-political level. And that's kind of a link that I try to draw in the book. And those things are related. So obviously, you can talk about on the social-political level, there's this realization that human difference is good for the fact of a kind of flourishing city or flourishing society. There's the quote that I use in the book that this idea that social harmony is dependent upon, for example, the king taking advice from different people, you know, and not being too homogenous in that sense. But then that kind of social political understanding of the necessity of diversity, I argue, is ultimately rooted in the metaphysical view, then rooted in a particular perception of the nature of natural order. So I think that a lot, if you look at the ancient Chinese texts, what you kind of overwhelmingly have a sense of is that, okay, these ancient people, they were sort of observing nature, and what they discovered in nature is what they perceived and interpreted in nature was the fact that everything is following its own dictate. So in Chinese, you say that it's 自然. So I think some people might know that term. It means autopoetic, something that is self-sowed, that is, you know, it's not caused by anything prior. It's following somehow its own kind of dictate. But then the Chinese, you know, I'm thinking that they could, these putative Chinese thinkers who are observing nature also observe that, okay, everything is following its own dictates, but then there isn't some kind of disharmony or chaos, even though everything is doing its own thing. They ended up seeing that it was compatible. There can be things doing its own thing, but then overall, you could call it harmony, or you could call it order, or kind of dynamic order. And they attributed that to a kind of resonance between, even though everything's doing its own thing, there can be some kind of resonance between all things. Well, I think that social political philosophy is then rooted in that kind of observation, their interpretation of what they saw in nature. And then also that, yeah, okay, so these people then wouldn't go on to say that, okay, that order that exists in nature is because of a kind of grand intelligent design or predetermined grand design, and a kind of more theological tradition might go on to say it. They don't say that. So those kind of characteristics of their thinking lead to a certain kind of metaphysics, which is then reflected on that, on the social political level.
So what you're describing, this is the metaphysics of harmony that you talk about in the book, right?
Yeah.
Can you give me some more details about how different philosophers and texts sort of cash out this idea of harmony and its metaphysics?
Well, there's many different thinkers that you can draw on to give examples of kind of manifestations of this underlying similar metaphysics. I mean, I think people might have problems with me. People tend to not like this over-essentializing of Chinese philosophy. They'll say, oh, okay, there's different schools, they all say different things, which I agree with, it's true. But I think that there is still kind of this kind of broad kind of consensus. And I think that if you look at the Taoist texts, very, very much sort of demonstrate this tendency. But then in the Confucian text, the two texts that I think really exemplify Chinese metaphysics, this text called the Doctrine of the Mean, the Zhongyong, and then also some of the commentaries to the I Ching, you see very similar ideas in between the kind of the Taoist ideas about metaphysics and Confucian ideas about metaphysics.
And do these texts, these thinkers or these schools, do they themselves draw the connection to the social political world? Or is this a connection that you're drawing?
Yeah, I think that they draw the connection themselves. So in the text, such as the Zhongyong, they'll talk about how the sage is supposed to model themselves on nature, because nature is all embracing, you know, nature. And then, so every part of nature is doing its own thing, but then you should therefore be like the capaciousness of nature to be able to support everything doing its own thing. And then they model the virtue of the sage on this kind of all embracing capacity of nature. So they literally then say that the sage should model themselves on that kind of tendency of nature itself.
So a big part of your book focuses on questions of comparison and comparative philosophy, alongside a critique of the way Western metaphysics has emphasized social and political hierarchy and difference. I wanted to ask you a couple questions about these comparisons. And one is just what you take comparative philosophy to do, both descriptively and prescriptively. So you give an account in the book of what you call the old model of comparative philosophy, which I found very striking. That the old model, and this is a quote, only reveals that philosophies in the West find their commensurable counterparts in non-Western philosophy. In this place, you propose a new model for comparative philosophy. Can you tell me both about this new model and about the problems that you see with the old model?
Yeah, so I think the issue with comparative philosophy methodologically come with, I think, the onset of colonialism, because prior to that, I think all philosophy is essentially comparative, because you're drawing, if you draw on different systems of thinking, that essentially could be a definition of comparative philosophy. So in that sense, all philosophy is some ways comparative anyway. But when I talk about comparative philosophy and the models of comparative philosophy, I'm really talking about in our contemporary era, which is beset by the legacy of how our world order is constructed, and then these kind of modes of production of knowledge. And so the old model of comparative philosophy, like you've already mentioned, is very much Eurocentric, in that European philosophies are taken as the paradigm. You could call it universal. They're taken as universal. And so every other kind of philosophy is when you do non-Western philosophies, the only way you can really talk about it is within the vocabulary and the framework that is set by the model of Western philosophy. So even the terms that we used, for example, metaphysics, epistemology, moral philosophy, these kind of divisions obviously come from Western philosophy. So these are just like the rubrics that we work in now. And then, so the old model of comparative philosophy that I mentioned in the book, the problem that I found was, I mean, this is not necessarily their fault. I'm trying to sort of berate it. Well, you know, I do criticize it. I don't think it's good, but it's also a product of its time, you know. So for example, let's take the case of China. China, you know, even though it wasn't completely colonized in that kind of classical sense where its land was literally controlled, it's semi-colonized. And then also the intellectual colonization, what you could call coloniality, is just very, very much deeply entrenched. And so when you try to talk about Chinese texts, which are now considered philosophies, so for example, Confucius, the Analects or whatever, you're automatically doing it according to these kind of Western paradigms. And then that my problem with that was the overwhelming tendency was to produce works which merely kind of buttress the insights of Western philosophy. So in that sense, you know, Chinese philosophy became almost like a model minority. So any kind of interaction with Western philosophy wouldn't necessarily change anything essential about Western philosophy, because it's the paradigm, you know. But what then was the function of Chinese philosophy? It was merely just to sort of prove the insights of Western philosophy correct. And then it just felt like, well, what is that doing, really? It wasn't really a more interesting way of engaging with different thought structures, you could call it, if that's what comparative philosophy is doing. I thought that another way of interacting would be that so I drew on this line from the Analects where Confucius said, okay, in the company of two others, I'm always learning from learning something from the person that I judge to not be such a good actor. I make sure that I'm not doing what is bad habits myself, you know, but from the person whose habits I think are good, I learn something from them. And I thought, okay, that kind of interaction is maybe something that maybe we should try to work towards more. And so what I tried to instantiate through my project was that, okay, there is something that Chinese philosophy has as a kind of value or way of thinking that maybe Western philosophy could actually learn something from. And that's, I think traditionally it would have been a bit taboo. And then in that sense, it's much more of a mutual kind of interaction, because obviously Chinese philosophy has learned so much from, well, not only Western philosophy. Like I try to portray the Chinese tradition is a very syncretic tradition. So yeah, so it's really this model of comparative philosophy that I talked about is much more an attempt to be of mutual engagement.
So just picking up on what Chinese philosophy can teach us, to return to the last claim of your book, which is that Chinese philosophy is relevant for ongoing ethical debates. So can you talk a bit about how the metaphysics of harmony informs contemporary and social political understandings?
I observe that underlying the kind of psychology of racism, and really I'm talking about a particularly, well, people define racism in different ways, obviously, and when I define racism, I'm thinking specifically about those really, really noxious forms in which you need to exterminate people, or kinds of violence against other groups that are really quite irrational. You know, there's no any pragmatic motives in the kind of, when I talk about racial violence, what I'm trying to understand in kind of racial behavior and racial ideology is really the kinds of behaviors that can't be explained by something like economic motives or pragmatic motives, because everybody has conflicts, everybody's fight with each other for different reasons, you know, but there seems to be a particular form of behavior that's driven by what I would call racism, that it doesn't seem to be motivated by more pragmatic considerations. And so what I observed in behaviors that are informed by kind of worldview that I would call racist is very deep-seated metaphysical views about the world, because I really don't understand how those behaviors can happen if it wasn't if there wasn't so much at stake, and there has to be so much at stake for people to behave like this, and that level of what's at stake must be their metaphysical view of the world. And I actually draw on a very beautiful passage from James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, and he's speaking to his nephew, I think, and he said that, you know, the reason why you have to perish in the ghetto and then that you're not allowed to step out of your socioeconomic place is because the white people have particular vision of the world, and then you have a particular place in it. And then if you were to step out of place, then it would be like the whole cosmos will be on fire. It'd be like you waking up and you're discovering that the stars are still bright, and you know, even though it's daytime, so the whole sense of reality would just be completely upside down. So I observed that, so underlying that particularly noxious form of racism is a particular understanding of cosmic structure, which I've called the great chain of being, borrowing from intellectual historian Lovejoy, Arthur Lovejoy. And that is, well, really medieval metaphysics that's grounded in partly in Aristotelianism. And it just has this, there's just this sense that everything is already preordained to inhabit its place. So first, there's two assumptions in that kind of metaphysical view. One is that everything in this world was predetermined according to its essence to be a particular way, and then that obviously can't change. But then furthermore, these essences are then ranked hierarchically, and then difference necessarily means hierarchy. You can't just merely have difference. Different has to be one thing being better than another in a kind of this ascending order of perfection all the way to the most perfect things. So there's So that's one aspect that I observed in that kind of psychology, that there has to be a kind of this kind of order in this world. And then there is another aspect of racial ideology, and I think it has to do with dualism. And then dualism is very, very foundational to, you know, Greek metaphysics, and then also the Christian thinking that also draws a lot on that kind of Greek heritage. So, for example, the dualism between passion and reason, the body and the mind, the emotions, rationality, form, formlessness. And I think all of these things are then mapped onto that kind of racial psychology of the revulsion of what are deemed to be the other. So the other is all of those things that are that negative side of the dualism. So the body, disorder, chaos, passion, you know, sexuality is all the body. And whereas the nicer side of the dualism is reason, and then so what I observed is that really the racial psychology has a lot to do with this fear of almost mortality itself, because the other side of the dualism, so body, passion, the emotions, those are things that are actually very, very human, whereas the other side of the dualism is things that we would like ourselves to be, you know, things that are the eternal, and then the reason being an unchangingness. I think your question was, I've gone on a bit of a tangent, but I think you...
No, this is great. I love the Baldwin quotes presented to you, this metaphysical thesis. And the idea, right, is that this metaphysical thesis is one that undergirds a toxic racial hierarchy. And you propose in its place that the metaphysics of harmony that emerges from ancient Chinese texts and thought can offer, or does in fact offer, a different way of understanding difference, which in turn, right, sheds new light on critical philosophy of race.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I first of all diagnose that these are the kind of the problems that I'm trying to address. And it's exactly it, like you said. I think that, so what I propose in contrast to that kind of medieval metaphysics that I've described, and which really is so explicitly tied to European colonialism. If you look at the way that especially the Spanish, when they justified their conquest of the American continent, it's explicit because they were scholastics at that time. So they literally draw on Aristotle. It's not even like my interpretation of it. They're just like literally drawing on what I've just given account of. And what I kind of contrasted with that, and what I proposed in its stead, is this kind of metaphysics of harmony, which then is rests on that particular Chinese kind of metaphysics that I described earlier, which is this idea that there isn't this dualism in nature, which that kind of Greek medieval metaphysics rests on, in the sense that that kind of Platonic or Aristotelian metaphysics would say that there is this putative material or matter that can be separated from form, or what you could call relations or order. There is this idea that you can separate them, because, for example, in Aristotle's four causes, you have the formal, efficient, and final cause, and those are causes, but then those are quite similar, but then the other cause is material, but then there is this idea that you can have this separate thing, which is just matter that is without form. And then, which is why the understanding of potency in the Greek tradition then comes from this idea of putting a form onto matter. And I use the Platonic idea of, he talks about where things in our world come from, and it comes from the form being printed onto matter, and that happens in this putative place called the chora. But then, like, that again speaks to this idea that form and matter can be separated, and then the potency of the thing comes from the form. But then in Chinese metaphysics, you don't have that idea, because you just don't have this dualistic idea that the form can be separated from the matter. And then instead, each thing already has its own kind of potency, which cannot be separated from somehow this idea of the matter of the thing. It just, everything already has this kind of potency. And then to sort of be efficacious or in the world is then how it is that you deal with the existing fact of the potencies of the world, how you create relationships according to what already exists, given that all things already exist within their own kind of potencies.
Do you think that this is particular to racial hierarchy or difference, or do you think this is just one specific example of a broader phenomenon?
Yeah, so I think that the idea of the barbarian is one instantiation of this idea that form can be separated from matter, because how I interpret it in the book is that the concept of the barbarian in Greek thought, and especially Aristotelian thought, is that he is kind of just matter without form. So in Aristotle's idea of natural slavery, you have these kind of beings who are kind of human in shape, but then they're completely devoid of reason. And so they're kind of just like roaming in the world, and then they have to be controlled by the master. They have to follow the master because the master sort of embodies reason. And in that sense of the master then imposing his reason onto the slave, as it were, or the natural barbarian, as it were, the slave or the barbarian now partakes of reason. So it's kind of like this grand metaphysical structure that, okay, if matter necessarily has to obey the form or kind of reason, these things are all tied together. Okay, so I'm trying to suggest, and because of this very different metaphysics in China, where you don't have this separation of matter without form, you don't really have this idea that, they don't have this idea of barbarian. And I think that would just be indebted to the metaphysics. You just don't have this idea that things need to have form imposed on them. And one instantiation of that is ideas about humans. You wouldn't have this idea that there is some group of something that exists in the world without its own potency, because that is what the barbarian will be. It lacks its own potency. It's chaotic, you know, because it lacks reason. It's merely chaotic, and then it needs the potency of reason being imposed on it. And then so that kind of framework wouldn't exist in that Chinese way of thinking. So you know they would have conflicts with other people for different reasons, but not for that reason, because they're just completely absent that kind of whole, that way of thinking. That's just one instantiation of
So we could talk about the details of the book for the whole time, and I do encourage everyone listening to go read the book and think about these details some more. But I wanted to take this as an opportunity to move away from the content of the book onto your process of writing it. So just going back again to that Baldwin quote and the inspiration you took from it, I was struck in reading the book just how you weave together all these different sources, right? So we've talked about ancient Chinese philosophy, about Baldwin, Aristotle, contemporary philosophy of race, but there's also, the big part of the book is anthropology and history. So how did you go about bringing together all of these varied sources?
So I think I've always been interested in relating philosophy to contemporary issues. And I think because I grew up in China, but then I moved to the UK when I was 7. So I think I've always had this kind of outsider's perspective on kind of both cultures. And then I've always noticed just how much human beings are motivated to act by their, what you could call their ideology or the kind of the worldview. If you just inhabit one particular culture, you sort of become blind to how much a lot of your assumptions are very culturally contingent. And I think I've just always been very, very fascinated since I was very young by how different cultural frameworks, or you could call it different philosophical frameworks, just fundamentally different philosophical assumptions about the world then govern and motivate human behavior. And so my first book, so it was about culture. It was actually trying to show that Confucianism and Ernst Cassirer actually had very similar conceptions of culture and how, and then their conception of what the human is. But then this book was really trying to do more looking at the differences, I guess, more sort of genuine to my initial instincts and my interests, sort of, I guess you could say, in terms of my growing up, just how different worldviews really shape conduct. And that's what I kind of try to show in this book, so first of all, there are different conducts, and you can explain these things through the social sciences, but that's kind of the thing that I find really, really dissatisfying, that somehow like human behavior can be all just reduced to purely kind of material explanations. And I'm trying to provide, humans create their own cultures, create their own philosophical worldview, and then these things have like a real huge impact on the way that they then inhabit the world. So that was kind of my interest. Like I said, I've always had, for different reasons, I had this interest in ideas about pluralism. And so that was a good topic with which to explore those that kind of interest that I had.
Part of our podcast trait is to think about what it is like to do research on these topics that not many others work on. So I wanted to ask a bit in that spirit about some of the challenges in doing the work you do, especially in drawing together all these different traditions and time periods in quite the unique way you approach it.
Yeah, thanks for that question, because this book is very multidisciplinary. And that was actually something that I felt quite difficult to do, because it's really kind of going out my comfort zone. Because I think that this book can be read by people in Chinese philosophy, Western philosophy, comparative philosophy, Western history, Chinese history, international relations, and decolonial scholars as well. And then I think all of those disciplines are big disciplines, and they have their own kind of very hardcore standards. And then, so, you know, I felt that for my argument to work, because my argument was empirical, because I'm trying to build an argument on my understanding of Chinese history, so, and then Western history. So it's an empirical argument. It wasn't sort of a merely theoretical one. So for my argument to work, seeing as it rests on this kind of empirical basis, I had to make sure that my book could be read by people from all of these different disciplines that I'm not a part of, like history or international relations. They can read it, but then I can stand their test, as it were. So that's something that I felt was very difficult. And if you notice, the first chapter of the book is a brief sketch of Chinese history as it pertains to cosmopolitanism. And, you know, I had to sort of learn it on the job of how to sort of write history. Because I had to like condense like thousands of years of Chinese history into sort of one chapter. So I guess anybody who does kind of interdisciplinary work would come to the same kind of conclusions. But that kind of challenge is, it was pretty difficult. But hopefully if it works, then, you know, if it works, then you're able to have kind of insights that you couldn't have unless you were able to take that kind of stuff on. So,
And what about the flip side of this question? What are the joys of this work for you?
So if I was able to be successful and if my arguments do stand, then I hope to have shown how valuable it would be to interact more with different fields. So for example, I mean, even within Chinese philosophers don't really interact with, for example, decolonial philosophy. There's many different reasons for that, which I won't go into. But so, you know, just for that one example, if I'm successful, and then there's sort of valuable insights that I've been able to draw, insights that are well argued, then, you know, I've shown that, okay, so Chinese philosophy should engage more with decolonial philosophy, and then, or maybe international relations should engage more with, think more about the philosophical bases of their, you know, their methodologies, for example, or just the views about international relations might be different given that you have different philosophical cultural backgrounds. So it would be very joyful to me that I was able to bring different perspectives to many different people who inhabit different disciplines, just basically like taking them outside the box a little bit. That would be a joy, a potential joy. It's not there yet. If it works, I'll get it.
Okay, and with that, I will take the opportunity to say thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you and to read your book.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Happy to talk to you too.
Thank you for listening to New Voices. Production of the podcast is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada as part of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project. The music you hear is 17th century female composer Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Pizzeria Armonici. For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website,
newnarrativesinphilosophy.net.
New Voices is a continuation of the New Narratives in the History of Philosophy podcast. You can also find past episodes under that name in all the same places.
We look forward to discussing all these new figures and ideas with you.